Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And we are so glad to have a friend of the show on with us today, Fran Meyer, editor at First Things and also the author of True Confessions. And Fran, you wrote a beautiful reflection that while we were waiting for Pope Leo's encyclical, you titled AI and the Miracle That Makes Us Human. And it's a lovely, heartfelt read that unpacks so much truth. And it came with some homework assignments, including a movie assignment that helped us prepare for Pope Leo's document. So, Fran, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
So the Pope signed Magnifica Humanitas on May 15th, and originally we were going to speak with you before the Pope's encyclical came out, but now, even better, we get to talk to you after it's come out. And this encyclical came out on the 135th anniversary of the publication of the landmark social encyclical Rerum Novarum, and we've been sifting through it, but we're dying to know, what are your first impressions of the document?
Oh, I just think it's the best thing that's come from the Vatican in probably 15 years. I was absolutely struck by it in a very powerful way. I'd gotten used to being disappointed by what was coming out of Rome recently, over the last decade in particular. But in the last months of the Francis pontificate, the dicasteries, I think it was of education and faith, a doctrine of the faith, issued Antiqua Nova, which was a document on artificial intelligence that just made me wake up. I mean, it's a terrific read and very, very perceptive about what's happening in artificial intelligence. And that document, combined with a document from the International Theological Commission, those two documents kind of act as the intellectual superstructure for his encyclical. But the thing that was most striking about it is that the encyclical reads like it was written by a human being. I mean, a person who has really thought about these things. And it's kind of a good portrait of the mind of Leo, very consistent with his Augustinian tradition, and also very consistent with his namesake, Leo XIII. I mean, he's dealing with something that is transformative of our era, and he's doing it in a way that any ordinary Catholic can read the document and be really moved by it. It's very logically organized. It's very beautifully written, accessibly written, and it really, in a sense, completely surprised me, because I spent 15 years as an editor in chief at the National Catholic Register, and I got used to reading a whole lot of, well, suboptimal material, and this was just, it read beautifully, but more importantly, it's loaded with content, very logically presented, that makes his arguments come alive, like that Tower of Babel image at the beginning of it, is just a terrific. You have that in your head as a visual image, and it becomes an opportunity to expand on the idea of human pride and the possibility of artificial intelligence becoming a new kind of Tower of Babel. But it's not all negative. I mean, he outlines. I could go on talking about this for an hour. I mean, the thing that struck me was he makes his initial points, and then he proves those points throughout the document in a very flowing and intelligent way. I mean, he gives the best oversight of the development of Catholic social doctrine that I've read in a very long time. Mm-hmm. How one thing came after another and followed logically, how each pope of the last century has contributed some unique insight into the development of social doctrine, which of course tracks back originally to Rerum Novarum in a systematic way. So those are the things. Another thing that really struck me was he does not allow pessimism. I mean, there's a wonderful portrait, I think, maybe graph 142, I forget what the exact graph is, where he talks about the importance of each life contributing to this effective reaction to the negatives of our age. I mean, there's a tendency, given the huge scope of transformative technologies that are happening, to think, well, I'm powerless. Well, we're not powerless.
Yeah.
Every one of our lives touches other lives in a way that has a cumulative effect that's very, very powerful. So I'm a fanboy. And I'm aware of the weaknesses in the document too. I mean, I think he, for an Augustinian, I mean, this guy's an Augustinian. I think he is too optimistic about international organizations, and I think he's also too optimistic when he says that war is always always avoidable. That's just not true. I mean, human beings are imperfect, predatory animals that have been redeemed by the cross. But we're still predatory and we're still sinful. And that results in conflict. And conflict can get ugly and we have to defend ourselves. So those are the things that I think faithful Catholic critics on the right tend to focus on and diminish the power of the document. But I don't think they do. I mean, every one of us has to use common sense in thinking about things like, you know, when is violence really le morally legitimate? And sometimes, unfortunately, it is. And that's never going to change because we're not going to change in this side of the Jordan, you know. But put that aside. You can read this document and really be profoundly inspired by it. And it's coming at, in exactly the right way at exactly the right time. And that's why I'm so positive about it.
I had a similar takeaway in the sense that I felt strangely comforted by the document, and I think, he has an admonition in there where he essentially says you can't sit on the sidelines, that we don't have the option of just being passive about this change that's coming at us, and that actually seems like a profoundly Catholic sentiment, which is, that things are always changing, and that brings with it fraught moral dilemmas. So what is a takeaway that you have from the document as to how we can engage with AI, or how we are called to not be passive?
Well, I use AI all the time. I've been in video games for 40 years and I just love technology. And so I use Gemini and Claude literally every day, but I never use it to write except to do some research and stuff like that, you know. I think though, here is how I would answer that, Ashley. I mean, I think when we talk about totalitarian systems, we think about people in jackboots and, you know, Orwell and the Soviet gulag and all that. But there's another and very effective kind of totalitarianism that emerges in a novel like Brave New World. I mean, we're living in a culture that creates an enormous anesthetic and comfortable and almost narcotic effect on everyday life so that we don't want to raise difficult issues. We don't want to get involved. We just want to kind of flow along with life and enjoy it and be anesthetized by it. And that's a different kind of totalitarianism, but I think that, and it's not an intentional one, but it really emerges from the experience of everyday life. We're tempted not to think. We're tempted not to engage with our kids. We're tempted not to disagree with the masses. And we have to. I mean, that's what our baptism is supposed to give us, the power and the consciousness to do that. I think Leo is calling on us to do that. Now, what's the plan? Because Americans love plans and platforms and commissions. Well, there isn't one. You have to make this up for yourself. You have to find other people, consciously find other people who believe what you do and who can reinforce you in your strength, and you can reinforce them in theirs as you accomplish things that you can in the opportunities that God gives to you. Now, the problem is nobody wants to do that because plans sound great because somebody else is going to do it. We have to do the hard work of our conversion ourselves. And that's another theme that I drew out of this from Leo is that, you know, if you want to change things, well, do it. Stop talking about it and stop complaining that the government doesn't have a program for it. Just do it to the degree that you can. And of course, nobody wants to do that. I don't want to do that. It's a lot of work, but that's how you got to live your life if you're a Christian. Everything about the moment we're in is anesthetic. You know, I mean, we don't know the war. We haven't had a war on our soil in 160 years. We haven't had we haven't had a discomforting moment since the end of the Second World War, and before that, of course, the Great Depression. But two generations have grown up in this country assuming that the worst thing that can possibly happen is $4 at the gas pump. That's just on another planet from reality. And we have to, I mean, I try to say this in a way that people will listen. And of course, they don't because frequently I don't. But I mean, we have to get away, we have to get in the habit of waking up and forcing other people to wake up, which is uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for us. It's uncomfortable to people who listen to us.
So, I actually said that you had gave a little assignment in the First Things piece, which was a movie by Steven Spielberg, Artificial Intelligence. And you had aspirations to be a Hollywood guy yourself, but God took you in a different direction. I know that's what you originally wanted to do, was to make films.
That for 8 years.
Yeah. Oh, that you did for 8 years. Sorry. What is it about this movie that is required watching, and how does that fit in with Magnifica Humanitas?
Well, I mean, the movie, I mean, it's one of his best works. It's really terrific. But it's about an android kid who doesn't understand why his mother can't love him. And of course, the mother can't love him, not because she's a bad mom, but because she knows he's not a real human being. And it's just it's a wonder, it's a melancholic movie in the sense that the whole movie is him trying to find his mother and do whatever it takes to have his mother love him. And I find that just I mean, it's really in the heart of everybody. In other words, it's a version of Pinocchio, the Pinocchio story. You know, how do you become a human being? Well, you become a human being by loving. That's what's the transformative experience of humanity. It's not, you know, building the Tower of Babel or create, you know, inventing some new chemical code or whatever. I mean, what makes us human and what deeply, deeply satisfies us is loving, but then also being loved. I mean, we have to feel that love ourselves so that what does love accomplish? Love accomplishes you have a right to be here. You know, and I find that enormously powerful. And I think that everything in this encyclical, you know, I mean, the encyclical doesn't make any reference to AI, the movie, but it's motivated by that same love. I think that's one of the reasons why it's not simply an experience of the intellect. I mean, John Paul is probably the greatest. John Paul and Benedict were probably the greatest Catholic intellectuals of the last century. I'm a huge follower of their work. But what makes this thing so moving is that everything that Leo is talking about flows out of this kind of knowledge that it's really love. I mean, you know, I mean, again, being an Augustinian, he would be very familiar with the Augustinian line, you know, our love is our weight, you know, our weight is our love. I mean, the love lifts us up toward the divine, which is why hell is cold. You know, there's no love there. So I guess I was just profoundly surprised at the quality of the document. I think if you look at the things that have defined pontificates, if you want the most brilliant exposition of a pontificate, it's Wojtyła. You know, I mean, Redemptor Hominis. Everything that came after that, you know, was an expression of it. Very, very carefully thought through every element of Catholic life. I mean, it's just really beautiful. And of course, Benedict, there's nothing that he writes that isn't brilliant. But this was quite interesting as an opening salvo of the way a pope thinks. It was going back to the past. It was showing the path from Leo to where we are today, and it was adding something completely new. I just thought it was great.
Well, on the topic of love, you wrote in your First Things piece, "Today's transhumanist imagings exemplify a hatred of the body's inadequacy, a disgust with the material fabric of humanity, and all such hatred has a metastatic DNA." But then you look at the loves of your life and you end with Blaise Pascal, quote, "The heart has its reasons, which reason does not know, and no machine can ever know. It's that broader capacity," this is now you writing, "we call love. It's the miracle that makes us human." So there's so much panic about AI, and there's this panic about transhumanism and is it going to take over the world? Is it, I mean, I think there's realistic concerns about what it's going to do to the workforce, which I understand. People are worried about how that's going to change that. But then there's this deeper panic. Do you think it's because culturally we've lost sight of the meaning of what makes us human? You know, to me, I'm so not concerned about, you know, the threat of like transhuman. I mean, in some respects, I feel like we're already there. We've already so demeaned ourselves that I'm more focused on what's happening right now. But I don't know. What do you think? What do you think?
Well, you know, I that's a really interesting question because I think as a culture, we know we've lost the narrative.
Yeah.
I mean, what's Remy Brog, the fabulous French Catholic philosopher, has written a book called The Kingdom of Man, which just tracks the beginning of the life and the death of the Enlightenment Project. It's just brilliant. But what is that? I mean, it's the idea that we don't need God and that we all can create our own reality. Well, when you do that, you don't have a common shared thread to your civilization. And also, it doesn't work.
Right.
So everybody's got this sense that, hey, this just isn't working. Why isn't it working? Because we've been sold a bill of goods about how it's all about us. We have the power to be whoever we want to be, which is total nonsense. We can create ourselves again. If you have any experience of a family, the idea that a child creates him or herself is just completely nuts. They have to negotiate with their siblings. They come from their mother and father. They have a whole universe around them, people who love them or don't, and the it's just you're happy. What you just said about you're not worried about these things because you're surrounded by people who are human beings who love you and whom you love, and but outside that is this vast world of people who just don't have the storyline at all anymore. They
Yeah.
understand that some things are good in a generic way and some things are bad, but they have no compelling reason why. I mean, Judaism and Christianity have the compelling, that biblical framework for understanding why we're here. And secular society no longer has it. It's not even remotely affected by it.
The
I'm
first
not an
thing is
optimist, by the way. In case you haven't noticed that. But I am a hopeful person. I shared this. One of the reasons that I worked so long and so well with Archbishop Shapu is that we shared exactly the same pessimism and hope. I mean, if you talk to Archbishop Shapu, he'll tell you that his two favorite saints are Francis of Assisi, that's obvious, but also Augustine of Hippo, because Augustine was exactly this type of person who looked at the world, understood its very realistically its flaws and its failures, and the likelihood that it wasn't going to radically change in the future. We were still the same animals 2,000 years later, but hope, because we have been redeemed.
Right.
And again, back to this issue of love. I mean, God loves us. We're loved.
You wrote a lot about that in your First Things piece, especially the idea that no one is unloved. And it really all goes back to the passage in John, because he first loved us. And if he loves every one of us, then one of the big tragedies of our time is obviously abortion, and especially the killing of the disabled through genetic testing. So we're marking the 100th anniversary of the birthday of Jerome Lejeune,
Great man.
the scientist who discovered the extra chromosome that causes Down syndrome. I know you know well about all this because you're such an advocate for the disabled, and you are the parent of a Down syndrome son. This recent influencer couple that took to the internet to broadcast their decision to abort a baby over a possible Down syndrome diagnosis really went viral. I mean, I didn't see much positive about it. People were pretty outraged. What do you wish this couple knew about children who have Down syndrome and families that have Down's children and siblings?
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, in our family, one of the many benefits of Dan's life, our other three children are never going to be biased against the disabled. And I think that there's a sadness about that couple that I thought about all morning when I was walking. I mean, if you I didn't see the video, but I did read their posting. And And the thing that struck me about the posting was that unintentionally, probably, they were casting themselves as the victim. You know, oh, we're so sad, we're so sorry. There's a tendency in an indulgent culture to kind of ex think that admitting that this was a difficult problem or that this was a bad thing apparently to do g gives you exoneration. It doesn't do that. I mean, the child is dead. The child is not coming back, and they're going to live with that in ways that will go a very long time. So, I mean, I have a sympathy with the kind of naive shallowness of what they did because they've done something as influencers and expected kind of a affirmation from their followers or criticism from the barbarians who don't like them. You know, it's all shallow. And so they've killed their child, but they've also killed something in themselves because they've denied not just that child's life, but all of the life that would come from it. I mean, Dan's 35 now, and what you learn very quickly is that they have all the same personality traits that the rest of us do. Now, are they closer to heaven? Sure, you know, because they don't have the capacity to commit certain sins. But Dan is a very shrewd dude. I mean, he understands really good-looking women, and he knows how to play the victim around them, and he knows that it works, you know. But he's also, you know, he's not above lying, and but at the same time, he also have a has a deep, you know, the guy is a comp you'll enjoy this, Betsy. He is a complete fanatic about Mother Angelica. I mean, he will spend an hour
I love it.
watching Mother Angelica and saying the stations with her. You know, and then 2 minutes later, I'll come in and he's watching some woman do gym jumps and all this other stuff. You know, his equipment is fine, but but they're human beings for heaven's sakes, and they force us because of their needs. They force us to be engaged in a way that we might not otherwise be engaged. By the way, there's another thing that maybe it was either you or Ashley brought up. You know, about this transhumanist thing. It's very important to understand that our bodies are part of us. They're not some sort of separate mechanism that wears out and we get irritated with it, and we have this kind of little man in our head that is the real me, you know. Our bodies are part of our humanity. We are not humans without them. And that's why it's very important, I mean, with a child like Dan, to touch him. I mean, to massage our, you know, to so that he feels not just, I can say, I love you very much, Dan. And I can get him good things and I can feed him. But if I don't touch him, I'm not locating him. And so he needs that. And you have to make a point I mean, you know, embracing them and reassuring them with your touch. And I mean, when we pray with Dan, we put our hands on his head, you know. I mean, just knows that. But Dan has also made us depend on each other in a new way. You know, we're never going to have the empty nest divorce thing. You know, I mean, it's not going to happen because reality will never allow us to get to the threshold of that. And you know, I have to say this too, Betsy. You know, and I want Ashley to hear it because I mean, she's young, quite a bit younger than me. I mean, Sue and I are 77 now, and we've had all of the routine setbacks and failures and disappointments and rough parts in our marriage. But when we look back, you know, it's very reassuring. And what that couple did is prevent themselves from having that experience. And it's sad. It's just sad. And the other thing too is that when I was in the industry, back in the film industry, you know, I mean, I was very conscious that hot actors sooner or later are not hot anymore. You know, I mean, they have their time in the sun. And they're very talented and they earned it, but it never lasts. Very, very rarely lasts. And when you're an influencer, sooner or later that influence is going to run out because people are going to get tired of you, or you're going to get old, or you know, all those things. And then what do you have? Well, you have that memory of almost being pregnant or almost having that child, and you'll never know the answer to what would have happened if that child had lived and what that might have brought you. I really do. On one level, I'm really irritated with them. Because they did a stupid, destructive thing. But on another, I just have a kind of weird sympathy for them because they're going to have to live with this. And what they're enjoying right now, they're not going to have in a short time. It just never lasts, you know. That's why people who pull a ripcord on a marriage 15 or 25 years in, they're not even halfway. I mean, Sue and I have been married 56 years, and I wouldn't give away a minute of it, not a minute of it.
Well, it's all the more the reminder of how important the Pope's document is, because where would we be on these conversations if we didn't have the church to point our attention back to the truth, back in the right direction? And it's kind of unbelievable how much of that time is spent pointing us back to basic truths again about what it means to be human and love. And so we thank you, Fran, for your beautiful insights and all your beautiful writings over the years on these truths, and especially now in this moment. So, Fran, where can our listeners find your work, follow your work?
Oh, geez. The well, I
Everywhere.
yeah, no, not at all. But I mean, I write for First Things, obviously, and I write a we semi pardon me, a biweekly column for the Catholic thing. But Ethics and Public Policy Center, where I'm a scholar, has all of my work over the last pretty much all of my work over the last few years. They do that with all of their scholars. And if you go to the eppc.org, and then look under scholars, you'll find my name. And you'll get a lot of other really good stuff from the other scholars as well. So yeah, I just have to congratulate you on the work that you've done yourself. You know, you've been very generous in your praise, but the two of you do an enormous service by with this radio show. People need to hear this stuff. They need to know that there are other people out there that are doing good work, because then they don't lose hope. You know, they're not isolated.
Well, thank you, Fran. And thank you for joining us today.
You bet, my pleasure.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And today we are going to delve into a favorite book of Pope Leo's, a book that is near and dear to his heart, The Practice of the Presence of God by the 17th century French Carmelite friar, Brother Lawrence. And the Pope actually wrote an introduction to a new edition of the book. And we are happy to have Rebecca Dougherty on with us, who is hosting a new podcast on the book, providing commentary and insights alongside her brother, Father Gregory Pine, the Dominican priest who was just on our show. Rebecca, it's great to have you on today. We are big fans of your brothers and excited to hear more about your new venture with this book.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I have to admit, I am reading the book right now. Caught my attention when the Pope mentioned it. And we've also been really exploring a lot about Fulton Sheen on our show. And what inspired me to start the book was Fulton Sheen's emphasis on the importance of the holy hour has got my husband and I starting to do a weekly holy hour. And I was looking for a book to start me off. And this was the book that I landed on. So can you tell me what made you decide to delve into this book?
Yeah. So I was invited by my brother, who's been a regular contributor on Ascension's Catholic Classics podcast. It's a bit of how do you call it? Like an alliterative mouthful, a Catholic Classics podcast, The Practice of the Presence of God. So this is the fifth season that Ascension is putting out on the Catholic Classics. They offer a whole host of products and formation and really wonderful things, but they have a line called the Catholic Classics. And so Father Gregory had done, I think he hosted a podcast on St. Augustine's Confessions and Introduction to the Devout Life by St. Francis de Sales. He might have, and then there were other contributors to the other seasons. So having navigated this before and being good friends, in addition to being brother and sister, and knowing that I have a theological background. So I have a degree in theology and in British American literature. I taught various groups over the years before now being home to teach my children in our homeschool. He invited me along for this journey. So he pitched it to Ascension and they said yes. It's wonderful in that Brother Lawrence talks about divine providence in this book, how God is present to all of us. He's already providing for things we can't even begin to think about or worry about. He's already there, paving the way. It was providential that Ascension had actually gotten the ball rolling on this project before Pope Leo made the announcement that this was an influential book in his spirituality. And so how beautiful that, yeah, this is where the Holy Spirit led Ascension. Where the Holy Spirit has led Pope Leo and, the Catholic world, the world at large. So I really appreciate as so I read actually the copy that you were holding up, Ashley. I ordered it on Amazon to, do a little pre-work, and then Ascension actually had the book retranslated and republished. And so the first time around, I was struck by how this book is over 300 years old, has sold a million copies. As you mentioned, it's written by a Carmelite, a lay brother living in the monastery, a monastery in France. And yet, what he writes is so applicable to a Catholic wife and mom, a Dominican friar, grandparents, students, people in the business world. What he offers us is beautifully profound and simple, and I think applicable to everyone. And that's simply that God is already present to us. So he is present to everyone everywhere. And rather than drumming up, new little devotions or self-help projects, which I would say that's a struggle of mine. Sometimes I get unknowingly in the mentality of like, okay, I'll scrub myself up, then present myself to God, and then he can do with me what he will. Brother Lawrence simply says, God is already present to each of us. So we simply need turn to him, be present to him as he's already present to us. So very simple, and I think a very profound way of loving and being loved by the Lord.
Pope Leo talked about the book on a flight with journalists, and he said it's a very simple book by someone who doesn't even give his last name, Brother Lawrence. How does that strike you? And also, can you talk about the structure of the book? Because I have a different edition. I have one with the introduction by Henri Nouwen. It's divided into conversations and then letters. How does that work for having a discussion?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's in the Ascension edition, and you might find this in other editions, there it's divided into four parts. So part one is composed of conversations that Brother Lawrence had with a man by the name of Joseph de Beaufort, who was a vicar general of a renowned bishop at the time. And Joseph de Beaufort realized at some point, ooh, this guy is good. And he has beautiful insights to share, not just with himself, but with the world. So he's the one who compiles a lot of this work and presents it to us. So part one is conversations. Part two is a series of letters that Brother Lawrence wrote to lay people, religious women, a priest. And so his audience really is everyone then and now. And then part three is composed of the spiritual maxims where Brother Lawrence writes directly, okay, this is how you practice the presence of God. This is what I mean by the presence of God. This is how you start. This is how you might get a little better at it. And fear not, if it's a struggle, you'll get there by the grace of God. And then part four is the eulogy or in praise of Brother Lawrence, where it's a little bit about his life. And so, in terms of conversation and commentary, so F Father Gregory is a pro at this. He's on a number of podcasts. He's been doing this for years. He preaches and teaches regularly. So he was very generous in that we both did some pre-reading and preparation, and then we got together ahead of the recording, and then during the recording, I would say he played the host. And then we talk about kind of an Alexia Divina approach. What struck you? What might be striking, excuse me, to the reader and the listener? And then in a practical application way, how could we go forth from this chapter, this part, this episode, and practice better the presence of God?
The thing I've been really struck by is the emphasis on kind of simplicity and humility. And so it almost didn't surprise me when I saw that Pope Leo said this was so influential on him because, we've had him as a Holy Father for 1 year and he seems like a very humble man. He has a certain humility of spirit that's so beautiful. And just side note, I just love thinking about the fact that even the Pope is still, ongoing spiritual formation. But I mean, how can people, we live in an age that's the opposite of humble. It's a very egocentric, narcissistic world. We all have platforms. We're all promoting ourselves. So how can we, in a practical way, apply this theme that's in this book, that so characterizes this book?
I recently wrote an article for Church Pop entitled "The Three Reasons Why the Practice of the Presence of God is Perfect in This Influencer-Obsessed World." Like you said, we all have a platform. We're all trying to garner our audience and, get the likes and subscribes, whether that's actually online or, in life. And I think so simply and profoundly and beautifully, Brother Lawrence reminds us that we already have an audience. And that audience is the infinite loving God of the universe. So it's reminiscent to me of, I don't know if you've seen A Man for All Seasons, this movie on St. Thomas More. There's this poignant moment where Richard Rich, a friend of St. Thomas More, comes to him and says, basically, like, can you get me into the English political world? And St. Thomas More says, why don't you be a teacher? Like, that would be great. You'd be great at that. And Richard Rich asks him, yeah, but who would know if I'm a teacher? And St. Thomas More says, you would know your family and friends, your students, and God, not a bad public. And I think Brother Lawrence reminds us through his writings here that we have this incredible audience all the time, and we simply need to open ourselves up to that, lean into that. And so I think, when we have the temptation to question, so I'll just speak from a wife and mother standpoint. Sometimes it feels like my efforts might be underappreciated or lost on my little audience members. But God is, he sees it all, and he's sanctifying us and strengthening us and making us saints through the little washing of the dishes and the folding of the clothes and the one more time of, I was working this morning, so I homeschool my children, and my one son is learning to read right now. Maybe it's our personalities, whatever it is, we tend to butt heads. And so this morning we'd kind of like ramped up to this, like, okay, what is this word? And like, let's try it again. And so I just thought, maybe because I'm steeped in this practice of the presence of God, reading and reflection right now. Okay, sorry, Peter. I'm really sorry that I'm impatient with you, and I'm sorry that, I was getting frustrated. Let's try again. And so I think it sounds so simple and maybe not effective, but yeah, those are the big things I think for all of us. Just apologizing one more time. Coming before our children, our spouse, our congregation, and saying, I'm sorry, or you hurt me. Let's try again. Do I find that to be helpful? And I think the book has helped shape that in me, especially recently.
I'm glad you brought up your kids. You and your husband Dan have five children. Where do you think this book falls for family reading? Is it accessible for children, maybe little passages, or for teens? We're in the midst of or the beginning of summer, so is this good for parents who might have teenagers who are addicted to scrolling or to look at and to really begin a spiritual life on a simple level?
I think it would make so the format of the book is it comes to us in little clips, so a letter, a conversation, a spiritual maxim. And so I would actually recommend perhaps doing it as a read aloud as a family, 5 to 10 minutes in the morning. Let's take one letter, one conversation, and then just chat again, Lectio Divina style. What struck you? How could we apply this as a family? The language is, yeah, very, I would say, simple and straightforward. And so, yeah, I think teens could definitely read it on their own. And then even younger children, it's great. Yeah, great material to chat through as a family and try to apply.
I think for a lot of people, the challenge is the actual getting into the presence of God part, especially for moms and kids, but really for everybody, for people who are busy at their jobs. Talked a lot about how distractible we are today. So, do you have, whether it's practical things that you've implemented in your life or lessons that you've extracted from Brother Lawrence, who is writing this in a much calmer, quieter time, and also much calmer and quieter environment than most of us are in, even those of us without kids, to actually make that step to get into the presence of God.
He writes, so he was in the kitchen for a chunk of
All
his
right, I
service
love
as
the
a leader.
kitchen stuff.
And he talks, here and there about how difficult, or it's not maybe his pick in the pool to be in the kitchen. And I'm in an environment where it's like we joke that the soundtrack of our home sometimes is ma, 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 ma,
Yes.
ma. So I think like, ooh, to be in a quiet kitchen by myself, that sounds delightful.
Right.
Yeah. Or to be sent out. He talks about how he's sent out to buy wine for the monastery, and he's afraid he's going to fumble it. But then he comes back and he entrusts it to God, comes back and thinks like, oh, I actually did a great job. I'm like, hey, to be sent out to buy wine for the house, that sounds great. But he makes a distinction, and Father Gregory comments on this in one of the episodes. So the podcast is 20 episodes. It started yesterday. Ascension is releasing one episode a day. So day two was released this morning. But Father Gregory talks in one of the coming episodes about how the practice of the presence of God is not a replacement for a concerted prayer time. So he says we still make the effort to carve out some prayer time, and then the rest of the day practice this presence of God, which Brother Lawrence, I'll just read from Brother Lawrence, describes it in, this is part three, the spiritual maxims. So he says the presence of God is the application of our mind to God, or a recollection of God as present. It can be performed either by the imagination or by the understanding. And then he kind of rolls through a list of synonyms, or ways of calling, ways of naming the practice of the presence of God. I imagine hoping that one resonates with, each of us, perhaps differently. So he says it's a simple act, a clear and distinct knowledge of God, a vague or general and loving gaze upon God, a remembrance of God, attention to God, silent conversation with God, trust in God, or the life and peace of the soul. And so for me, when I read through those descriptions, a vague or general and loving gaze upon God, and then silent conversation with God. Those are the two that kind of resonate with me. And so what I find is most helpful is to get, I'm naturally an early riser, but I try to get up before everybody in the house and at least get some, half hour of, I get my cup of coffee, light a little candle, and basically just talk to God. Okay, here's what's coming up today. Here's, could you please help me with this? Thank you for this. And then I'm in my mid-40s, but I taught teenagers for years, and they loved doing the kind of the Bible roulette where you just like open the Bible and then let your eye land on a page. So I still do that as a 44-year-old, and oftentimes that God is speaking to me through that passage or through that line, and I'll continue to reflect on that throughout the day. So then in terms of practicing the presence of God, how I try to do it is I've actually stopped. I used to multitask as much as I could. And lately I've been talking to God about the ever-present to-do list, where I had this experience. I had, let's say, 10 things on the to-do list, and I just rocked and rolled one day where I crossed off seven things. I only had three left. Then the next day I accumulated five more, and then the day after that, seven more. And it hit me. Okay, there will always be a to-do list. So Lord, please help me integrate this to-do list within my life so that I'm present to the moment, getting stuff done, but also enjoying, the gifts that you're offering me in and through each moment. And so the way that I've tried to practice the presence more is trying to stop multitasking, actually. So when I'm standing at the sink, chopping vegetables for a salad, I used to listen to a podcast. Or, I'd have a friend on speakerphone. We're catching up on a conversation after playing text tag, trying to get in touch with each other. I'm now trying to just chop the salad and then either let my mind wander, or, as Brother Lawrence said, have a vague and general sense of God talking to him about, okay, thank you for this today. I'm sorry for that. Please help me with this. Or when I keep going back to doing the dishes and folding the laundry. They play big roles in my day-to-day life. When I'm folding the laundry now, again, instead of listening to something while I'm folding the laundry, I'll either chat with my kids who might be in and out, or just be quiet and kind of think my own thoughts. Allow those thoughts to kind of like settle in and, yeah, lead to where they're meant to go. So I find that helpful then in recalling God throughout the day, rather than like, always being on the go.
Well, it's pretty incredible that a book that was written so many hundreds of years ago still feels so incredibly relevant today, especially as evidenced by the fact that the Holy Father himself calls it one of the most the biggest influences on his spiritual life. So, Rebecca, we thank you so much for joining today to give us some of your insights. And where can our listeners go to follow your work and to tune in to this exciting podcast?
Yeah, so they can go to ascensionpress.com. There's also readers, listeners, viewers can download a daily reading plan from the same site. And then on the Ascension app is where people will find these 20 episodes. So each episode is, I'm going to say, about 15, 20 minutes. The first half is reading, Father Gregory and I take turns reading a portion of the Practice of the Presence of God. Second half then is us providing commentary, ending with some practical takeaways and a prayer. So that's available on the Ascension app. And then also Ascension just started an Ascension Catholic Classics YouTube channel. So viewers and listeners could go to YouTube and just look up Ascension Catholic Classics.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca, for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. God bless you.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. I'm Betsy Fentress, and I am joined by our TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry, to talk about a very important consecration and novena and feast happening this week. Monsignor, what can you tell us about the big Sacred Heart novena going on at the behest of the USCCB?
So not just a novena, but we're going to have the consecration of the United States to the Sacred Heart of Jesus on Thursday, June 11th in Orlando. I am in Orlando as we're speaking, participating as an observer at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops annual summer meeting. But it's going to culminate during this 250th anniversary of the United States with consecrating our whole country to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. That's an enormously important reality. You know, it was interesting that when the bishops last November were proposing that we do a consecration in this 250th anniversary year, they were planning to do it on Friday, which is the Solemnity of the Sacred Heart. That made all the sense. But one of the archbishops stood up and he said, could we move it to Thursday so that we would be able to return to our own dioceses and make that consecration with their people? And that was a very popular suggestion that passed easily. But nobody really knew at the time that when you were switching from June 12th to June 11th, two things were happening. The first and the shortest is it was the 75th anniversary of the Episcopal ordination of soon-to-be Blessed Fulton J. Sheen, my predecessor at the Pontifical Mission Societies. He had a great devotion to the sacred humanity of Jesus, to Jesus' divine and human love beating in his Sacred Heart, which is what the Sacred Heart devotion is about, and how fitting it is that he's going to be able to be echoed three quarters of a century after his Episcopal ordination. But the bigger thing was in 1899, on June 11th, Pope Leo XIII consecrated the entire world to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. He consecrated not just Catholics, not just Christians, but the entire world, including all those who were not Catholic, to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, to Jesus's divine and human love for us, and to the way he took on our humanity so that we might take on his divinity by receiving his gift of grace. On the exact 100th anniversary of that 1899 action by Pope Leo XIII, St. John Paul II put out a letter in which he said, what Leo XIII did on June 11th, 1899, is one of the most important actions in the history of the church. We could spend a whole Conversations with Consequences episode and why John Paul II argued that. Anybody who wants to read his arguments can just type that into a Google search engine, find the document, and read it for him or herself. But what the U.S. bishops are doing this June 11th in consecrating our country is one of the most important things that Catholics have ever done in the history of the United States of America. And so I apologize on behalf of priests everywhere if you haven't heard that yet, for example, in your own parish, if you're listening to this program here, if you haven't read the various articles and National Catholic Register about it or seen it on EWTN. But this is a super big deal. And so I'd really urge people listening, if you happen to hear this by Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m., to tune in to EWTN, where you're going to be able to watch it live. If you tune in and are listening to this on Friday or Saturday morning on EWTN, go to EWTN Demand and just watch it, or go onto the usccb.org website and pray along with it. Because for this consecration to have the impact the bishops are hoping and that Christ would desire, it's not just an act of our shepherds, but it's supposed to be an act of the shepherds in the entire flock. So the more of us who prayerfully unite ourselves, the better. That's what's happening this week, Betsy.
So once the consecration happens, what can people do to continue that devotion to the Sacred Heart, on behalf of our country?
Well, the first thing would be to go to Mass on the Solemnity of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. It's not a holy day of obligation, but it's a solemnity. It's one of 10 solemnities or huge feasts that take place over the course of the year. That would be a great way to ask Jesus, as we have for centuries, O Jesus, meek and humble of heart, make my heart like unto thine. Jesus himself asked for a devotion of First Fridays, that on the first Friday of every month, we try to make time to get to church, to make a good confession, to receive him in Holy Communion, because devotion to a Sacred Heart is intensely Eucharistic. Jesus himself made that connection to St. Margaret Mary Alacoque just over 350 years ago. And that's one of the reasons why the Sacred Heart Feast happens originally at the end of the octave of Corpus Christi, or now, since Corpus Christi was moved from Thursday to the Sunday after, 5 days after Corpus Christi. But the two feasts are related. And so every time we go to Mass, we're receiving Jesus' sacred humanity together with his divinity, and his, like, so we receive his body, blood, and soul, but we also receive his divinity in Holy Communion. And Jesus wants to give us essentially a heart transplant when we receive him, taking out our hearts of stone, to use the words God inspired the prophet Ezekiel to give us, and replace it with a heart like his Sacred Heart, a heart of flesh, a heart that beats with love, a heart that knows how to say yes to God, a heart that is able to embrace others, a heart that's able to be steadfast when it needs to be, and compassionate when it needs to be. And so Mass is obviously great. And one of the things that I particularly love about the devotion of the Sacred Heart is praying the Litany of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. It's a beautiful litany that we can pray on First Fridays or on Fridays or anytime somebody likes, because it brings us in, pun intended, to the heart of the mystery. Just say one last thing. Pope Benedict said that the devotion of the Sacred Heart of Jesus is the essence of Christianity, because we're focusing on the incarnation of Jesus when he took on our humanity. We're also talking about the summit of divine love. And so, if that's true, then we can't really be fully vibrant Catholics without a devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. I may have mentioned before that sometimes we're kind of repelled from the devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, because if there's any statue in the history of the church that has been badly painted, it is the statue of Jesus. Sometimes, like, you're putting lipstick on Jesus, and it's such a kitsch statue, and you wonder if he's going to be in some type of pride parade because it's just such a bad, bad paint job. But I particularly like Batory's image, which I was seeing last week in Rome from the Gesù, which shows Jesus really manly, really humanly, with a heart on fire. And if anybody sees this new movie on the Sacred Heart that is coming out this week, I was able to review it with an advanced copy. The graphics by which they make Jesus's heart burn in that film really is the best I've ever seen. And so, for that reason alone, I'd encourage people to go try to see that Sacred Heart movie. But that Sacred Heart docudrama, it's 90 minutes long, likewise will nourish your faith in seeing how many people were brought to conversion once they recognized the deep love of Jesus, which we mark this Thursday and Friday.
What a beautiful feast. Thank you so much, Monsignor Landry.
God bless you, Betsy.